problem this morning. I copied the wrong lecture notes to my drive, and I put them and posted on the web. So what I'm going to do I do have a copy of some notes that sort of backup notes. I'll try to work from these during the lecture today, and then we'll also go out. We'll go out to a Wikipedia site to look at some other things, and then I'll send my back. I'll send the correct notes to the class. Post the correct notes on the web, which is a shame because I spent a lot of time on those notes. Is it? I have 8:01. Is that what time? It's okay. Because these clocks are all off. So these are the lecture today. We're trying to demonstrate the use of MLLR decoupled from HMMs. I wanted to present an example where we use MLLR, but we don't really use the HMM framework. And the notes that I have here, this is work that Sundar, one of the students sitting in the class, put together. We've been working on this example for the past couple weeks. And the notes, these four or five slides, are a sketch of that outline, and then I cleaned it up a bit for the course notes. So I'll try to work from these a bit, and then we'll use the real notes when we, I'll post the real notes when I get back to the office. So what we wanted to try to do in this derivation is to just consider the problem of adapting the mean and variance of two Gaussians. HMM structure involved. So we have, for these Gaussians, we have a mean and a variance, and let me put that in the full screen mode. And there's two mean, there's two Gaussians, so there's a mean and variance for each of them. We'll use a scalar scalar observation vector, so that we only have to deal with one parameter. So if you recall from our MLR formulation, we are using this extended mean vector 1 and mu sub I, and then we multiply that by a parameter vector wi0 and wi1 to transform the old mean mu sub I into the new mean mu sub I hat. And we then similarly are going to have to transform the variance from sigma sub I to sigma sub I squared. We'll do that by a scalar constant S sub I. And our goal is to essentially optimize the values of W's and S for a new set of adaptation data. So we've used an existing set of training data to estimate mu sub I and sigma sub I, and then we want to use this new data to estimate mu sub I hat and sigma sub I hat, sigma sub I squared hat. Now we're going to assume that this data is modeled by a Gaussian. So we have these two Gaussian distributions, N1 of x and N2 of x. And these distributions, then, we have our standard Gaussian formulation in terms of the observation vectors x and the means mu and sigma. So for those of you who came in late, I loaded the wrong notes onto my jump drive. So these are not the final class notes, and I posted the wrong notes onto the website. But this is a sketch of the notes. This is something that Sundar, who's not here yet, and I were working on, and I'll go through this because I had this on the jump drive. But when I get back to my office, I'll post the correct version of the notes, which has a more extended explanation of all these things. So just bear with me. We'll kind of walk through some of this today, but these notes are not as complete as the actual class notes. And one of the, because we have this exponential form of the probability distribution, it's going to be convenient to work with log probabilities or log likelihoods. So when we take the log of this distribution, then we get this constant term plus a term related to the variance, sigma sub I, and then this quadratic term raised to the e power just becomes the quadratic term itself. And that allows us then to get some kind of linear equations for re-estimation of these parameters. Now there's a couple key points here about the MLR approach. One is that when we have this new data set, we've talked about the fact that one possible thing to do would be to simply estimate the new means and the new variances from that new data set. And that's actually what a technique called maximum a posteriori adaptation does, and that's something we're going to talk about next. But the advantage of the MLR technique is that we're doing that adaptation through a parametric transformation that can be shared across different Gaussian distributions. And that is an efficiency that's very important in adaptation approaches. Similarly, the weakness of the MAP approach is that if you're simply going to re-estimate these from the data itself, you're going to have to actually observe instances of these events to be able to re-estimate the data, those parameters. And in a lot of applications, when you have a small training set, you will not observe instances of all of your Gaussian distributions. Okay, so I think everyone's here now, so I'll say once more that I posted the wrong notes. The notes we're working through are just a sketch of a derivation prepared by Sundar. But when I get back to my office, I'll post the correct notes. So I'll try to remember all the things I filled in on the class notes as we work through these. So with the MAP approach, which is really based on estimating a new sample mean, the problem with that approach is that you can only estimate parameters for which you observed instances of those parameters in the new adaptation set. And for a very complicated, large pattern recognition system, a small training set is not going to exercise all of the modes of the system. So there will be many parameters for which you cannot estimate parameters because you don't have instances of those states or those events occurring within the training set. And then if you do try to re-estimate a subset of your parameters, then you have a problem that some of the parameters in the new system have been updated and some of the parameters in the system have not been updated. And that's a bad mismatch type condition. So what's important about the MLR approach is through this parametric transformation, we can share these transformations across different states. And that allows us then to re-estimate all the parameters in the system as long as we have instances of data corresponding to these transformation matrices, which is a much, much smaller set. So you might have, for example, 10,000 Gaussians or 10,000 states in your system, but you may only have 5 or 10 transformation matrices which are shared across all these different states. So as long as you have in your adaptation set at least a few occurrences of these 5 transformation matrices, you can then go and update all the parameters in the system because they're essentially shared or clustered. And the good thing about that is you can make the decisions about clustering and sharing of these transformations in some kind of statistically optimal way. We talked about that, I think, last class or class before. So the MLR approach is nice because it allows you to scale the complexity of your system to the amount of adaptation data that you have, versus the MAP approach where you're really stuck with needing several instances of every parameter in the system, which may not be feasible for small data sets. So that's an argument for why we want to re-estimate the mean using a transformational approach. Okay, so we have this this formulation for the mean and the variance, and now what we want to do is to explore how we're going to estimate these W's and this S given the new adaptation set. So, as before, we're going to assume that we have t observations of the new data. In this sketch, we'll call them x. In our previous derivation, we called them o's. And we have this auxiliary function, which is key to the re-estimation of these parameters. We talked about the EM theorem, where we essentially maximize this Q function, and that's the we do that to find our re-estimation equation. So in this particular case, we have the two Gaussians, so we have the sum from I is equal to 1 to 2 over those two Gaussians, and then we have T observations, so we have the sum from T is equal to 1 to capital T for each of those observations. Now the key thing here about this function, which sort of is related to Hindmarkov modeling, is that you'll notice that we're summing over both, we're summing all observations over both states. So we're essentially using this auxiliary function to estimate the probability that these observations could have been produced by either of these two states. We're not, another way to do this would be to make some hard decision about what observations belong to what Gaussians or what states, and then to simply do that re-estimation. But what we're doing here is we're asking the question, for each Gaussian, what was essentially the probability that this observation sequence could have been produced? So we have the sum over the two Gaussians, and then the sum over all the data for each one of those Gaussians. And then we have the joint probability that we observe the data, and the notation here is a little bit tricky, but this is essentially, when you sum over T, you're essentially computing the probability that for each one of these observation vectors x, or scalars x, and we're actually assuming that the contributions to this Q function is an entropy-like term, which is the probability of that observation times the log of the probability of that observation. So we have the probability of when we compute this, we're going to take the probability of, for example, O sub 1, given that we're in that we're associating that observation, O sub 1, with Gaussian number I, Gaussian 1, for example, given the model lambda. Lambdas represent our current model. And then we multiply that by the log of that probability, but given the model lambda hat, which is our new model, our adapted model. Now, if instead of lambda hat here we had lambda, we'd have essentially an entropy-like term. But with lambda hat, we have essentially a cross-entropy-type term, and that's key because we need an equation which relates lambda hat to lambda. And by differentiating this auxiliary function, we'll be able to arrive at an equation which tells us, if we want to maximize this function, tells us how to compute lambda hat as a function of lambda and a function of the new data. Now, this notation, I actually in my notes I changed this notation a little. This H sub t equals I essentially just denotes the ith Gaussian. Sundar uses the term hidden state here, but we want to try to view this in somewhat independently of hidden Markov modeling. So this is just asking the question, what is the probability that each one of these observations was produced by the ith Gaussian, and summing up those contributions. Okay, so is that clear? Because this is, I think, kind of the hardest thing in these problems is to set up and understand the Q function.
Dr. McCone?
Yes.
Hey, this is Oxford. Since in lieu of not having the notes, do you think the audiovisual operator can lock in on the whiteboard for us?
Sure. Actually, let's see.
There we go.
Yeah, well, let me try to send you this PowerPoint that I've got.
That'd be great. If you could do that, that'd help a lot.
So if you just give me a second in class. Again, I apologize for this. That should just take a second. If if someone from the remote site could call in and verify that you received those attachments. I sent this PowerPoint sketch that I'm working from and some MATLAB code that we're going to talk about at the end.
Dr. Cohn, we've got it. Thank you very much.
Oh, great. Okay. So sorry again. Very sorry about this. It just so happened that I was working from two sets of lecture 20 notes, and I grabbed my pattern recognition notes instead of the last notes.
But, Dr. McCone, one second.
So while we wait for them to get in sync, The auxiliary functions are probably the hardest thing to set up in these problems, and the thing that I think makes this a little bit challenging is these things tend to be associated with hidden Markov modeling or algorithms like that because of the this idea that you're going to sum over all possible ways the data could have been generated, and that usually involves some aspect of hidden state modeling. In a lot of problems that don't use hidden state modeling, you would simply know the models sort of corresponding to the data, and you wouldn't have to do this sum. But here we're actually summing. If you think one way to think about this is we're summing over all possible ways the data could have been generated, because we don't know how the data was actually generated. So we have four T observations and two Gaussians. We have two times T terms in this summation. Is the remote site ready? Hello, remote site. Are they still on? Online?
You're on. It's not responding.
Okay, well, hopefully nothing happened like out there. Okay, well, I'll continue and hopefully they'll jump in a moment. So what we want to do now is to look at how we can decompose this probability into something that we can calculate. And this is the one section of this derivation that I'm still a little unhappy with. So we'll go through it, but I want to continue working on this a little bit. So this what's common to do, this is actually, this P of X comma H sub T is equal to I given lambda. This is both a conditional probability and it sort of has a joint probability element associated with it. And we want to decompose that into something that we can more easily measure. So we can write that the probability of having the data associated with the ith Gaussian, which in the hidden state modeling scenario we talk about as being in state number I, but here we want to stay separate from state, so just think about this as the probability that we're associating a particular data sequence with the ith Gaussian, given the data, all of the data, x and lambda. So this is a conditional probability, but it's conditioned on the joint event of the data and lambda. Now, there are a couple things that still bother me about this term and the way we're going to decompose it. You'll notice we keep using this term T, because normally in a hidden Markov model, we look at the data sequentially as a function of time. But we're trying not to do the time dependence here. And Sundar, I'll ask you to listen to this carefully, because I'm still not completely sure about the gamma. And we'll see that when we go through your actual MATLAB code.
Okay.
But where you kind of ignore the gammas.
Yeah, we're going to assume that's one.
Right,
that's
right, 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 which is a problem in terms of generalization. But what we're trying to do here, the data is not necessarily temporally ordered. So this probability that we should get the same probability whether the data occurred in any order. And that's actually part of what's called the conditional independence assumption. And you can sort of see that here, that we're just summing up these probabilities over time. And it doesn't really matter when they occur, because if you interchange the order of these sums, you'll still get the same overall probability. However, buried in this probability is typically a Markov process, which does worry about how the data occurred. Because if you think about in a Markov process, you start at time zero, you end at time t, you're going to transition through a sequence of states. What this probability is actually the probability of being in state I at a particular time, given all these other things have happened in time. Now, we want to throw away all of those assumptions because we just want to kind of forget about the hidden Markov model aspect of this. So this should really be just the probability that the that observation T was associated with Gaussian number I, given, and that's what I'm a little bit concerned about here is this.
That takes us the set of all x.
That's the set of all x.
Right.
But in when we throw out the temporal modeling aspect of this hidden Markov model, then I think this should just be the a given observation.
Right.
O sub t. What in my notes I called O sub t or x sub t.
Exactly. Right.
And the t is a little bit misleading because it's not really time; it's just an index. And then given the model. Now that means that this gamma. And that's where I'm still a little bit uncomfortable. This gamma certainly is a function of I,
right.
But it's not a function of the t-th observation.
It is.
Because this term, because the observations can occur in any order. And if we then, and that gets a little worse, if we throw away this dependence of t, then these things actually cancel out in the final re-estimation formulas.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit, Sundar and I have a little bit more homework to do on this derivation. And that was one of the things that that we need to clear up in the actual copy of the notes. But in any event, let's, for the moment, let's just go ahead and use this term, but the actual explanation of this term needs a little bit more clarification because I'm not comfortable with it being conditioned on all of the observations because it doesn't reflect a overall path, it just reflects one particular observation. But nevertheless, if this is a conditional probability on this joint event, we can turn that around, and so we have the probability of, you could say, A given B comma C, and we know the conditional probabilities can be written in terms of the joint probabilities divided by the marginal probabilities, and we know that we also know from Bayes' rule that you can write the probability of A given B in terms of the probability of B given A using Bayes' rule. So we can write this as the probability of x of the observation x sub t and that being associated with state I, because remember any observation could occur at any state, so this a particular observation x sub t can be associated with either state number one or state number two given the model, divided by the probability of all these observations given the model. So this is essentially, this term is essentially the probability that a particular Gaussian generated the data over the probability that any of the Gaussians generated the data. That's essentially what this probability is. Now, for the two-state, this is sort of where I get, I'm a little bit concerned. For the two-state problem, the probability that state 1 generated the data or Gaussian 1 or Gaussian 2, these are just sort of an a priori probability, which could be uniform, could be not, but they're not a function of the index of the observation sequence. And that has ramifications. I worry about that when we get to the final equations, and I'll show that. But this is supposed to be the probability that that a particular observation vector is associated with a particular state over the probability that that observation vector was associated with any of the states. Now, in a hidden Markov model, that makes sense because you've got this sequence of things and you're really asking about what happened at one particular point in that sequence. But without the hidden Markov model, this is just essentially a prior probability of the Gaussian, which we can estimate based on some training data and then essentially keep that static for the iteration where we estimate the MLR coefficients. So we can turn this around then and say that this probability, the numerator, is equal to the gamma sub I of t times the overall probability of the data given the model. Then we can also note that since we're assuming a Gaussian form for that probability, we can write that the log of this probability is just going to be the log of the Gaussian. And if I go back to the previous slide, we said that we have a Gaussian distribution. So when we take the log of that, we get this constant term, which we can ignore during the maximization. We get a term related to the variance and a term related to the mean. And the variance appears in both places. The mean just appears in one place. So when we go and differentiate with respect to the mean, we'll even get further simplifications. So making these substitutions, we could then write that our auxiliary function is a constant minus the double sum of gamma sub I of t times the log of sigma hat, because we have the log here, and then we have the double sum of the quadratic term times gamma sub I. So this is looking promising because we have now the a quadratic term for the re-estimated mean, and then therefore when we differentiate it, we expect to get a set of linear equations. It could be problematic with respect to re-estimating the variance because we have the variance here and the variance here. So when we differentiate this with respect to the variance parameter, we could end up with equations which are messy. But for life sometimes works out nicely, and it turns out there's some when we differentiate with respect to the variance, we also get a fairly clean set of equations. So this is sort of the key step getting to this point, because from here out it's fairly straightforward. We just differentiate this and away we go. But are we okay on this, relatively speaking? I hope so. Okay. So what we're going to do now is to differentiate that term with respect to a specific weight, W sub I comma k. And that derivative, let's jump back to, did we lose? Is there an on-site out there?
Yep.
If they could call in and just let us know everything's okay. So when we differentiate this with respect, so we've got the W's and we've got the S. The S is the term associated with the variance. The W is the term associated with the mean. If we differentiate with respect to the W's, all of this stuff goes away, and we just have to worry about the derivative of this with respect to W. And the derivative of that quadratic term with respect to W, well, we can move the derivative inside the summation, because the summation is with respect to an index representing the observations. And we have then the derivative of the argument. Well, we've got a quadratic form, x minus mu hat squared, so the derivative of that is just 2 times x sub t minus mu sub I hat times the derivative of the argument x sub t minus mu sub I hat with respect to W, and that's just going to be minus the derivative of mu sub I hat with respect to W, and then all of that scaled by this constant term, 2 sigma hat sub I squared. So we can pull this derivative of mu with respect to W outside the sum, and we essentially then have the sum over the observations of this gamma sub I of t times x sub t minus mu sub I hat, all scaled by the sigma sub I hat. So now what we can do is we can set this equal to 0, and we can then solve for mu sub I hat. So we set it equal to 0, and we can solve for mu sub I hat. Well, in this case, we have the, you can think of this as the sum of gamma times x on one side and the sum of gamma times mu sub I hat on the other side. So we can write that mu sub I hat is equal to the sum over t of gamma sub I of t, x sub t, divided by the sum of gamma sub I of t. Now, this is where I still have some problems. Because if the gammas are not really a function of the index of the observation, then they essentially cancel here. And the new mean becomes essentially the sample mean.
Right. So in this case, they are, right? They are a function of sample.
No, that's where I'm having problems. Because there's no hidden Markov model, there's no temporal ordering here. You can permute, you should be able to permute the observations any way you want.
Right, so if you permute, then xt also accordingly permute. Still the...
Well, you can permute the xt's, but why should the gamma sub... I'm not...
Yeah, that will move accordingly. So
why?
If you move x1 to x5, even gamma I of 1 would move to gamma I of 5.
But what is gamma I of 5?
That's the relative probability that if it's gamma I of t, that's a relative probability that xt came from Gaussian I. So if you have two Gaussians, the probability that xt...
Right, but if I reorder the data...
Still the relative probabilities would remain the same.
Right. So what this gamma is essentially, if you think of let's say we've got 10 observations, and we're looking at the third observation. That we ask the question, what is the probability that third observation is associated with state 1? That's gamma sub 1 of 3. And what is the probability that that observation is associated with state 2? That's gamma sub 2 of 3. Okay. So this t is really just an index into the observation. Now, the computation of this gamma, that's again where it gets a little bit unclear, I think. That's just when you throw away the hidden Markov model structure, that's just the prior probability of the Gaussian, essentially.
Yeah, we'll have to estimate the probability that X was generated from each of the Gaussians.
It doesn't, and it does not, that computation, does that involve, normally when we look at a hidden Markov model, we're looking at the state transition probabilities for that.
Right.
But without the hidden Markov model structure,
it won't involve state transition probabilities, but it involves...
But it does involve output probabilities.
Right.
So it's essentially just a product of the output probabilities based on the observations, right? So it's
going to be... And the weights of the Gaussians. If all are weighted equally, so we would have any...
Well, there's only these two Gaussians.
But we can have different weights for those. Like one Gaussian may be more important than the other.
Right, but this sum over all the observations for this is the sum over stakes of I. So if the prior probability for the state, that's essentially we can think of as a constant.
Right.
It's some value, let's say 0.1
right.
for state 1 and 0.9 for state 2. Those have to sum up to 1.
Right.
Right. So the sum of these gammas has to be equal to what? We have two states. One has probability 0.1 and one has probability 0.9. The sum of these gammas are going to be essentially the sum of the output probabilities for each one of those observations associated with state number one. Right? So we have this Gaussian distribution. So remember that there, when you talk about a observation vector being associated with the Gaussian, there's two components to that. There's the prior probability of that state. One state may be more likely than another. One Gaussian may be more likely than another Gaussian. So let's assume for the moment, just to make this a little more concrete, that state number one has a probability of 0.1. Gaussian number one. I keep saying state, but I really mean Gaussian. Gaussian number one has a prior probability of 0.1, and Gaussian number 2 has a prior probability of 0.9. That means state 1 is less likely to occur, Gaussian number 1, than Gaussian number 2. Now, we could, in many problems, you may set these equal. You may say, well, all Gaussians are equally likely. But in the kinds of application spaces I work in, we actually make use of these prior probabilities. These are really important to the problem, so it's important that we factor those in. But then we also have the probability that if we're at state one, that particular observation was produced. Now, how do we compute that? Well, we simply plug in x sub t here, and we compute this probability. That's what's called the output probability. So there's essentially a transitional probability and an output probability. In the case when we throw away the Markov structure, the transitional probability is just the prior probability of the state. But we still have this O sub t minus mu sub I squared. So when we talk about the sum over t of gamma sub I of t, it's essentially the sum of the log probs. All scaled by this prior probability. Right, you heard that, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, is that clear? Now, this is something that the reason we call these things gamma sort of relates to the hidden Markov model development, where the gammas are actually intermediate variables that we compute as part of the von Welsch recursion and such. But looking at hidden Markov models in this structure, these gammas are just essentially the sum of the logs of these probabilities. Okay? Is that, you know? No? Yes? Because that's the hardest thing to grasp in this derivation. So these gammas, this is, if you think about what this really says here, why if all these things were equal, we'd just have the sample mean. If each state was equally likely and if all observation vectors were equally likely, we'd just take the sample mean. That's essentially what you've been doing in the past when you remember the scenario, you've got n existing data points, you have m new data points. Okay, before you ever came to this class, all you might do is take the n plus m and compute the new mean. Right? But what you didn't really think about in doing that was the fact that under that assumption, all the data are equally likely. And there's nothing wrong with that. Without any other knowledge, that's a reasonable assumption. But with with Bayesian modeling, we actually go one step further and we try to do some inference on how likely each one of those data points are and how likely that are the hidden states associated with those data points. So this denominator is essentially it's the sum of the probabilities of each one of the observation vectors. And each one of those observation vectors are not equally likely. Now, the probability of any one of these observation vectors, it's a function of two things. It's a function of the probability of that state, of that Gaussian or that state, plus the probability that that distribution generated that particular feature vector. And that's what we call the output probability distribution. So so in this case, since the prior probability of the state, since we don't have the hidden Markov model structure, this is just a product. Each one of these terms is just a product of the probability of that Gaussian times the output probability, which is generated from the Gaussian model. And then this term on the top is essentially the the product for, we step through each one of the observation vectors, the O sub 1, O sub 2, O sub t. And so we're essentially doing a weighted average based on all of the observation vectors. Now, again, this term, this is computed for each one of the states. So for state number one, we said that had a prior probability of 0.1. You're going to see that prior probability factor into both of these terms. And then for state number two, you'll again use the prior probability for state number two. And what we're essentially doing here is taking a weighted average. So what's going to happen is the data points, the X's, that are more likely to occur are going to dominate this computation. Whereas if you simply ignored the probabilities of the data occurring, this would degenerate just to an arithmetic average of the new adaptation data. Do you follow that? So this result has a really simple interpretation that we're computing a weighted average of the data. We're not simply letting each of the new data points contribute equally to the mean. We're computing a weighted average based on the probability of those data points. And that's sort of what's one aspect of this form of adaptation. We're going to see this over and over. We'll also see this with the map adaptation. That's one form of this adaptation that's somewhat unique. Now, the second thing that's unique about this adaptation is that if you remember, our adaptation equation is this extended vector where we have wi0 plus mu sub I times wi comma 1, which simply means we have a regression function for we're computing the new mean as wi0 plus mu sub I times wi1. So it's this linear transformation. And that's, the new mean is equal to this. So we now have an equation which says our transform mean is equal to this. This is something we can compute from the data. We still have to solve this equation. Unfortunately, we have a problem. There's two parameters here, but only one equation. Because we've chosen to use a regression model where we have, if you remember in our original regression formulation, we said a linear regression function was beta 0 plus beta 1 times x. That's what we have here. And we developed a way to solve for beta 0 and beta 1. But here, we only have one equation and two unknowns. And that's why the system is underdetermined, and we have to use then, we have to sort of create some additional constraint to solve these equations. Well, what we choose to do in this case is to use a pseudo-inverse approach, which essentially finds the solution of this equation under the constraint that the norm of this vector is as small as possible. And that second constraint is convenient because it turns out you can use singular value decomposition to solve that equation and produce that solution. That's sort of a well-known thing. But I would say that there are many different ways you could solve this equation, many different additional constraints you could impose. And probably it's not all that sensitive, I would think, to those constraints. But for historically, what people have done in this case is to assume this SVD approach to finding a pseudo-inverse because we're thinking ahead to the problem where we have speech data or data like speech data. We want a fairly numerically robust way to find this pseudo-inverse, and SVD is one of the more popular ways to do that. So that's the preferred solution in this case, which, as I said, is equivalent to adding the constraint that the norm of this vector, wi0 squared plus wi1 squared, is minimum. And that solution then becomes our final solution for the weights w. Okay? So now we've got the w's. And we just need to go back now and find the S, the adaptation for the variance term. So again, we can differentiate Q with respect to S, S sub I. And that derivative is a little messier because if you recall our formulation, we're differentiating this thing with respect to S. And if you remember that sigma sub I hat is equal to S times sigma sub I. So the derivative of sigma sub I hat with respect to S is going to be non-zero. So we've got the derivative of a log plus the derivative of this 1 over sigma sub I hat squared. So we've got to worry about the derivatives of those two terms. So we differentiate with respect to S, and we can move the derivative inside the summations, and we have the derivative of the log of sigma, which is just 1 over sigma times the derivative of sigma with respect to S, and then we have the derivative of some stuff times 1 over sigma squared, and the derivative of that is going to be two times 1 over sigma cubed times the derivative of sigma with respect to S. So this is the derivative of the log of sigma. This is the derivative of 1 over sigma squared. And we can clean that up a little bit by writing this term in this form and writing this second term just basically getting rid of the twos. And now what we're going to do is set that equal to zero and solve for S. So we set that equal to zero, which means we can write an equation which says this term is equal to this term, and we have that here. And we can then solve for, we can divide by a sigma hat sub I and solve for sigma sub I hat squared as, again, a very nice simple formula which says the sum of the gamma sub I of t times x minus mu sub I squared over the sum of the gammas. So the interpretation is the same as before, where instead of weighting these x t's equally, we're weighting them by the probability that they could have occurred. And that probability is a function of the model lambda. So this is one of the reasons why we get this iterative process, where we estimate the model from the existing training data. We then estimate mu hats and sigma hats from the new adaptation data. We can then plug those new estimates into the model and go back then and re-estimate these equations. So you can actually iterate on these equations, and that's typically what's done, is we iterate several times, usually about three times, on this process of estimating the new means and variances, updating the model, re-estimating the gammas, updating the model, re-estimating the gammas. And that's one of the reasons why we end up with an iterative solution. Now the relationship between the sigma hats and the s's was straightforward. We have sigma hat is equal to s times sigma. So from this equation, we can easily solve for s as just this thing times 1 over sigma sub I squared. So now we have an equation for re-estimation of the variance and an equation for re-estimation of the mean and the transformation parameters. So we've got a way now to adapt the mean. So we can actually try a numerical simulation of this. So what Sundar has done is he set up an example here where we have a estimate of the mean that was an variance that was arrived at from a set of training data. We then generate some number of new data points according to a new mean and variance. So if you remember in this adaptation scenario, you've observed data under a certain condition, and then somehow the environment changes and you get some new data points from this new condition. And the question is, how quickly, ultimately, you want to converge to the mean of the new data. And the question then becomes, how quickly do we adapt to the mean of the new data? Well, it turns out the adaptation is actually fairly fast. So here we have the training data, which represents the model lambda, which we have the estimated values for mu and sigma. And then we go ahead and apply our adaptation equations. So we're going to estimate these equations, and we're going to run T, capital T, from 1. We're going to start with 1 data point, 2 data points, 3 data points. So we're just going to start generating new data points and take that set from 1 to T and use those to estimate the mean and variance. And then we're going to be able to plot those estimates as a function of the number of new data points. And as you can see, we get a pretty rapid convergence of to the new mean. I think we'll look at the MATLAB code in a second, but I think it was either 200 or 500. It was 500 initial points.
Right.
And I think out to 200 new points. So this estimate was obtained with 500 estimates from a Gaussian random number generator. And then we're adding new data, and you can see how quickly we adapt and what happens as we adapt out to a large number of points. We do, in fact, converge to the new model, and we converge fairly quickly. So we can look at the MATLAB code for this. Thank you. So here we set up the training data. We have 500 points of training data. Here we set up the test data. We have 200 points of test data. And now we're going to go in a loop that we're going to re-estimate the mean and variance for each time we get a new data point. So we're going to start with one new data point, then we're going to add a second data point, add a third data point, and we're going to use all m of those data points to estimate the new parameters. So in this example, Sundar has assumed that the gammas are equal to 1. And I think we probably want to think about that, but we'll talk about that offline. So then, since the gammas are equal to 1, this just becomes the sample mean. So we compute the new mean. This is based on I of the, in this case he's using index I, based on I of these new data points. We then compute mu hat by doing the pseudo inverse of our extended by doing this pseudo inverse calculation of this equation, and that gives us the mu hats, and then we do a similar re-estimation of the variance, and then we've got mu hat and sigma hat, and then we go back and repeat that as we encounter a new data point. So those plots you see are of mean hat and var hat as a function of this index I. And so there you get an example of the ability of this MLR approach to converge. Now, again, the demonstration of this on a two-state problem isn't all that remarkable because we don't really have to worry about the need to share transforms and things. But if you look at previous class, I showed you some experimental results from a large speech recognition system where they are doing, they're sharing millions of mean vectors using a handful of transforms, 10, 15 transformation matrices, and then you get a much better idea of the power of this kind of approach. Okay, so this is about all I wanted to say about this MLR approach. Now we will look at other adaptation approaches based on these kind of transformation concepts. But this sort of concludes the section on MLR. So if there's any questions, we can discuss them. Otherwise, I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about the basics of map adaptation. Okay, people don't seem too excited about that. So let me go to, since I don't have the notes, let me go to the wiki page. And I think I can talk from so last time we talked about the general framework where we're going to want to maximize, we're going to want to essentially choose parameters which maximize the posterior probability. And in the case of our pattern recognition type problems, we can factor that into a product of the likelihood of the data given the model times the likelihood of the prior probabilities of the parameters of that model. Now, this is a concept which you're probably not familiar with or used to, because if we assume that all possible parameters of the model have the same probability, then that term G goes away, and then you're just left with the maximum likelihood estimate. And the maximum likelihood estimate of a mean, for example, is just the sample mean, just taking the data points and averaging them. So, but if those data points have different probabilities associated with them, then you're going to see some kind of term involving, for example, the gammas here that we just talked about in the case of the MLR example. So, you might ask, well, it's fine to postulate this kind of a framework, but what do I know about the prior probabilities of the parameters? Why should a value of 1 for the mean be more probable than a value of 2 for the mean, for example? Well, one thing, if we assume a uniform distribution here, then we don't really need to worry about the G, but it's very common in this adaptation scenario and other Bayesian type modeling to make an assumption about these parameters, to assume that the values of these parameters are actually distributed in a Gaussian fashion centered about the true mean, which we never know, but that's sort of hypothetically centered about the true mean. So we can actually look at the maximum a posteriori estimate of the mean given a data set under the assumption that the parameters of the model, the distribution of the theta, are multivariate Gaussian. And that's sort of the standard map derivation. That's really where the map approach begins. So I wanted to start by simply showing you that, and then we'll take this one step further next class to talk about it in an adaptation context. And then we'll also talk about it in a hidden Markov model context. So here we have, for the overall function that we want to maximize, a product of the prior probabilities of the model times the likelihood of the model. So we have the generator function, which is the probability of the model given a specific, this is the prior probabilities of mu, which we're going to model as a Gaussian distribution, times the product, given that mu, the probabilities that we actually observe the data x. So we have this multivariate Gaussian distribution, which we're going to model. We're going to again assume this conditional independence. So the product of the observing t of these observation vectors is just the product of the individual observation vectors. So we can just write that as a product of these Gaussians. Now again, if we assume that all the data are equally likely and all of the parameters, all the possible values of mu are equally likely, we have nothing more. This just degenerates to the sample mean. But if we want to not assume that, and we want to maximize this function, well, if you look at this carefully, you realize we have a product of exponentials here, which means we can simply sum the arguments. So maximization of this function is nothing more than maximization of this summation. And maximization of this summation it's minimization of this summation. So minimization of this summation produces nothing more than the estimate for mu. The value of mu that minimizes this summation is essentially this expression, which is nothing more than the sum of the x squareds weighted by this sigma sub m over sigma sub m squared plus sigma sub b squared, where sigma sub m comes from the estimate on the estimate of the prior data, and sigma sub v is the estimate of our, based on our new data. And there's one important thing here, which is n, the number of new data points. So as what's interesting about this equation is that you can see that as the number of data point, new data points goes to infinity, this will essentially converge to the sample mean as the number of new data points goes to infinity. And otherwise, we have the ability to weight the contributions from the new data points and the existing data points. So what we want to do next time is to take this basic approach and apply it to the problem of estimating the mean and variance of a Gaussian distribution in our hidden Markov modeling framework. And we can show that we'll end up with an equation that's very similar, except we'll also have factored into that the probability of the data itself, x. Okay, so if there are no questions, then we'll break, and we'll see you on Thursday.